Amen. All right, so if you weren't here last week, it's not going to be long, but we left off on kind of a cliffhanger last week. I don't know if you remember or not, if you read ahead to see what happens. But what we talked about last week was this guy, Jairus, who is a synagogue ruler. He was a man of standing and respect in Capernaum. He would have had authority on par with maybe a city council member, mixed with a junior or senior warden in a church, all kind of bundled together in one person. And this synagogue ruler, comes and he flings himself down in front of Jesus, and he asks for Jesus' help because his daughter, his little daughter, about 12 years old, is dying. Now, Jesus, as we saw last week, agrees to go heal her right off the bat. It was an immediate agreement. He just left to go do that with him. He had to push his way, or was pushing his way, through the crowd that had gathered on the beach. It's an urgent matter. Time matters right now for this girl's life. The words that the Jairus uses when he comes to speak to Jesus indicates that she's at the edge. She's at the point of death. And so there's no time to lose. It's urgent. And so they head off. But as they go, a woman who has been bleeding for 12 years, she's ceremonially unclean, we said last week. So that she is in the crowd means that no one has even noticed her. She's had to kind of sneak in and make her way through the crowd around Jesus and touch the tassel that was hanging from his garment. And immediately, we're told, immediately she is healed. The bleeding stops and she feels in her body that she's well again. And we said she probably wanted to sneak off at that point because she didn't want anyone to know what she'd done, that she had broken the ceremonial law, that she had touched everybody in that crowd, or at least she touched a lot of people in that crowd and made them unclean. So she probably wanted to sneak off. But what happens is as soon as her bleeding stops and as soon as she's healed, Jesus stops. It's important to note, the woman does not stop Jesus. Jesus stops, and he asks, and you see it in your text, who touched me? And that's in the perfect tense, so that means he didn't just ask it once, he asked it a number of times, probably because he wasn't getting an answer. He would say, who touched me? The woman wouldn't come forward. Who touched me? The woman wouldn't come forward. Who touched me? The woman wouldn't come forward. And finally, she knew she couldn't hide anymore, and she does come forward, and she confesses everything. All that we know about the woman who was bleeding, we know because right there in front of that crowd and in front of Jesus, she told her story. She told him what happened to her, what she'd done. It was a confession moment. And Jesus, as we saw last week, probably completely unexpected to her, he speaks kindly to her. He doesn't come down on her for breaking the law. He's not harsh with her. He speaks kindly to her. He calls her his daughter. He receives her as his daughter. That's the only place in the New Testament where that word daughter is used by Jesus for someone. It's for this woman who comes to him. And so he embraces her as his daughter. He sends her into the world in peace, but just as he's speaking, just as he's doing it, just as Jesus receives this woman as his daughter, Jairus, who has been wanting to get to his house fast, receives news from messengers that his daughter is dead. And you can see that in verse 35. While Jesus was speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, your daughter is dead. Now, before I had kids, I think I'd read this passage many times. Before I had kids, I could read past this thing in no problem. I mean, I could read books, I could watch movies, I could do all sorts of, or entertain myself in all sorts of ways, even if the story involved the death of children or the suffering of children or the kidnapping of children. I could think in a kind of a distant way, oh, that's such a sad story. But now that I have children, it's hard. It's actually personally painful to read a story where a kid gets hurt in any way. Could you naturally just imagine your own kid there? So I have to steer away. I never purposely read a story or watch a movie with a kid who's being hurt or a kid who's dying. The kid with the cancer movies, I just can't do that. I don't know about you, but I just can't. So just imagining this person's pain, Jairus' pain here, is painful for me. I don't know about you. If you have kids, maybe you're there too. It must have just crushed Jairus, these words. And here's what makes it worse. Jairus has done everything right. He's thrown himself down before Jesus. He's set his own future. We talked about the risks that he was taking in doing this last week. He set his own future down publicly in front of Jesus. And he set the future of his child down in front of Jesus. And he's come to the end of himself. And he has placed his trust fully in Jesus. Now, if you came to me and you were in a crisis and something terrible was happening in your life, and you said, "What should I do?" I would say this, what Jairus did. He did everything right. But, nevertheless, Jesus let his daughter die. Now you might say, "Now wait a minute, he just didn't get there in time. You know, if he'd gone a little faster, there wasn't the crowd, maybe they could make it." But we said last week, no. Way back on the beach, when he first heard about Jairus' daughter, Jesus merely had to say the word. And Jairus' daughter would be healed. He knew the urgency. And he decided to go to Jairus' house to push through the crowd. He knew the urgency of the moment. And when this woman touched him, instead of saying, "Hey, let's bracket that, I'll come back and talk to you later, I gotta get to this house," he doesn't. He says, he stops. And he speaks to this woman. And he spends a lot of time trying to get her to come forward. Jesus decided to let Jairus' daughter die. Now, if you've been with or in Jesus for any length of time, you are probably familiar with his no's. When you ask for something and you want something, you need something, and Jesus just doesn't give you that thing. I can remember times throughout my Christian life, especially in the beginning, but even so now, I'm not all that holy now, but back then I was even worse than I am now. And so often when I became a Christian, it would feel like everything I loved and leaned on and needed was being stripped away from me. But I've never had, in my walk with Christ, I've never had the kind of pain that Jairus must have now. I've never, thanks be to God, lost a child. But I have been with Christian parents who have. And one of the hardest things to face is the knowledge that Jesus could have healed. He could have saved my child. But he didn't. What do you do with that? Jairus' friends here seem to have a suggestion. You can see it there in verse 35. "Why trouble the teacher any further?" they ask. Jesus hasn't helped you. You've come to him. You've laid out your problem before him. He hasn't helped you. It's too late now, so why not leave him alone? Why not go on? This is the voice of religious pragmatism. Who knows what the word pragmatism means? Anyone? Huh? Thank you, Kelly. Yes, we're going to miss you so much when you go away. You just provided a great... pragmatism is you do what works. If it works, I'll do it. I mean, there's an American motto, I think. If whatever it is, if it works, we'll do it. And we import that philosophy into our spirituality sometimes. A lot of people are looking for a religion that works. I have a problem. I want a God who will fix that particular problem. Now, appealing to this mindset, we've talked about this before, appealing to that mindset, Christians sometimes with good intentions sometimes promise that Jesus is able to, or not able, he is able, but they promise that Jesus will fix everything. in someone's life. You have a Christian or a non-Christian friend, and you say, "Hey, well, you got a problem in your job. You got a problem with your relationship. You're sick. You have an illness, or you have a child who's sick. Jesus will fix that. You come to Him, and He will get you out of this particular problem." The problem is, Jesus has never made that promise. He didn't make that promise here to Jairus. He said, "Yes, I'll go to your home." He never promised that He would prevent his daughter's death. Jesus never promises to prevent or keep you away from disaster or trial or crisis or your death or even the death of someone you love deeply. He can, but He doesn't always do it. In fact, writing about this, and go ahead and turn to 2 Corinthians. Writing about this, Paul writes in chapter 4 of that book, "We who live," meaning Christians, you and I, "we who live are always being given over to death." We're always being given over to death, he says. That's not our best life now. This is not a health and wealth prosperity way of speaking about the gospel. We are always being given over to death, Paul says. Why is that? Why does God do that? Why does God allow these things to happen? Why has God let Jairus' daughter die? Why has God let whatever it is you're struggling with come into your life? Why? Why? You're already in 2 Corinthians. Just turn forward to 2 Corinthians 1, verses 8 through 9, because there Paul is recalling a particularly difficult time in his life. We've looked at this passage before, but it comes right into play again when we're understanding what's happened here in Mark. Paul writes this: "We were so utterly burdened beyond our strength that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt that we'd received the sentence of death." Why? Why would God let the Apostle Paul get to that point? Well, that, he says, he answers the question, that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. God's good purpose in everything, in death, in life, in sickness, in illness, in being fired, in whatever it is, God's good purpose is to make you rely not on yourself, but on God who raises the dead. That's what He's doing. That's what He's doing. See, because the problem is we naturally locate peace, joy, happiness, comfort, all those kinds of things, contentment. We naturally locate those things in our physical health, in the well-being of our children, in good relationships, and in career success, you name it. Those are the things that we need, or I think, I'll use me, those are the things I think I need to be okay and to be happy and to be content and to be joyful. And when one of those things is taken away, I'm not. But God uses heartbreak in each of those areas of our life. When He uses it, He uses heartbreak in those areas. He uses trial, even death, to draw us to cling to His Son Jesus. That's what He's doing. That's what He's doing. And if we have Him, we have then the true source of that contentment and that joy and that peace that we were talking about a minute ago. But it's peace that doesn't mean happy, happy, joy, joy, peace. It means if I have Him, I can bear all things. I'm okay. So if you skip forward to chapter 4, Paul explains, he had this experience that he talks about in chapter 1, but he explains what he learned, I think, through that experience and many others in verses 8 through 10 of chapter 4 in 2 Corinthians. He writes, "We," meaning Christians, meaning you and I, believers in Jesus Christ, "we are afflicted in every way, every way. Every way. But not crushed. We're perplexed, but not driven to despair. We're persecuted, but not forsaken. We're struck down, but not destroyed. We're always carrying around in the body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our bodies. We're always being given over to death for Jesus' sake so that his glory can shine through us in that moment of pain. And we ourselves will be drawn closer into his arms. That is, I think, Jesus' aim with Jairus. That's Jesus' aim with Jairus' wife. That's Jesus' aim with his daughter that he let die. That's what he's doing. And so, to answer the messengers, no, when all is lost, it's not time to leave the teacher alone. It's not time not to bother Jesus anymore at that point. It's time to cling ever more tightly to him. Even when you think there's nothing he could possibly do to help you, that's when you don't leave him alone. That's when you don't stop bothering him. Jesus says the same. If you look down at your text, go ahead and turn back to Mark 5. Look at verse 36. Overhearing what they said, Jesus says to the ruler of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. Now the word for do not fear is probably better translated, stop fearing. So Jesus overheard what the messenger said. He knew, he saw Jairus' heart. He knew he was just crushed immediately. And he looks right at Jairus and he says, stop fearing. And I don't know, if I were Jairus, I would just look at him and just, are you kidding? Are you crazy? Stop fearing, he says. And then he says, and a better translation would be believing. In other words, continue to believe. Well, believe what? I came to you believing that you could heal my daughter, and you didn't do it. So believe what? Now notice here, it's very important, Jesus makes no promise. You see any promise here? No promise about what he's going to do. He doesn't say, keep believing, and then I'm going to go to your house and raise your daughter from the dead. Doesn't say that. We only know that happens because we read the rest of the story. Jairus doesn't know that happens. It's going to happen. Jesus doesn't hold out any outcome, and that is purposeful because he doesn't want Jairus to continue to trust in an outcome. He doesn't want Jairus to continue believing in the outcome that he came to Jesus for. He wants Jairus to continue trusting him. Beneath the faith this man had that Jesus could heal his daughter was a faith in Jesus himself. That's what Jesus wants Jairus to keep on doing. Keep on believing. Even now, Jairus, even now, trust me. Trust me. That's important because some today define faith as believing something good will happen because you believe it will happen. Right? So I believe this good outcome is going to take place because Jesus has promised me happiness or whatever. I believe this good thing is going to take place. And so by virtue of my belief and my positive faith in that outcome, it's going to take place. If I just claim this thing today, it's going to happen, right? That's not faith. That's not faith. Give you an example of what I think Jesus means here by faith. If I'm a little boy, and I'm not now, but when I was, let's say I was 5 or 4 before I learned how to swim. I was about then I knew how to swim. If I'm a little boy and I don't know how to swim, and I'm standing next to a pool in the deep end, and there's a guy next to me who's maybe drinking it up, having a great time by the poolside, and I'm looking over the edge wondering if I should go in, and the guy says, "Go on, kid! have a little faith. Dive on in. What would it be if I dove in at that point? Stupidity, right? Foolishness. Idiocy. That's not faith. That's foolishness, right? Just jump in if I can't swim. Especially if this guy drinking there. He's not going to jump in and save me. Oh, look at him. He's trying to swim there. Right? But if I'm standing at the side of the pool and my dad's in there and he's holding his arms out to me and he says, come on, son, I'll catch you. Jump. And I do. That's what faith is. It's not trusting in an outcome or my power of belief. It's trusting in a person. That this person who's promised to be with you is going to be with you. This person who's promised to deliver you is going to deliver you ultimately. He's going to be there for you. It's who you trust that matters, and not merely the act of trusting. And that's what Jesus wants. Jairus, I know it looks horrible. Trust me. Can you do that? Just trust me, Jairus. Now, Jesus, let's go ahead and move on here. Jesus had been headed to the house with all of his disciples, but when he hears the girl is dead, he changes his mind. And in verse 37, we see that he allows no one to follow him except for Peter and James and John, the brother of James. Now, this is the first time that Jesus takes James, Peter, and John apart from the rest, and he creates at this moment or this time kind of an inner circle of confidants. And we're going to see that over and over again in Mark, and you see it in all the Gospels. Why them? I have no idea. I mean, Peter is loud and proud, obnoxious, and James and John are like they're kind of careerists. You remember those guys that came to Jesus and said, hey, give us two thrones, your left and your right, and don't worry about those other disciples. So I don't know why he picked them. He did. It doesn't make any sense to me, but there we are. A lot of things Jesus does don't make any sense to me at all, but he did pick them. We'll talk more about this inner circle later in Mark, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. I want to keep moving. Let's look down at verse 38. They get to the house, and when they get to the house, Jesus saw a commotion. People weeping and wailing loudly. Now, if we were transported back in time and we walked into that house, there's no way we would think we walked into a funeral. But that's what they were doing. Jesus walked right into the middle of a funeral. Now, our funerals are somber, solemn affairs. I've done a lot of them. People are very quiet. People are very dignified. People try to be on their best behavior. Even the family, you might hear some quiet weeping, but generally there's no wailing and mourning during a funeral. But in the first century, it was just the opposite. People would not wear their best clothes to a funeral. You'd wear your worst clothes because everyone had to tear their clothes when they got there. And you wanted as much noise as possible. Even the poorest Jew was required by tradition to hire two professional female mourners and one flutist. And the flutist's job was not to play music. It wasn't to play a nice hymn and get us to think wonderful thoughts about the person who's died. The flutist's job was to make noise, just play discordant notes from the flute. And the wailing women's job was to wail. I mean, just wail and wail and wail, make horrible screaming noises, screeching noises at the top of their lungs. And so it was chaos. It was commotion at first century funerals. Now, that's a poor guy would only have two wailers and one flutist, but a rich guy like Jairus would have had just a whole house full of noise and flutists and women screaming. It would have been chaos. Now, why is that? Well, I think one reason that is that first century Jews, unlike sometimes 21st century Americans, understood that death is a horrible thing. Death is a horrible thing. It's not good. It's not like the Lion King cycle of life. No, it's bad. It's an enemy. That's how the Bible describes death. So when I do funerals, I'm frequently told by people, you know, we want this to be a day of celebration. We want this to be a happy day, kind of like a party rather than a funeral. Let's put the F-U-N, the fun, back in the funeral. I'm sorry, that was a bad joke. So, Yeah, I mean, I understand the need for that. I understand that you want to look back on this person's life and celebrate that person's life. And I also understand that the person's a Christian, that that person is with Jesus and is happy. So we want to rejoice about that. But a big hole has just been torn and ripped out of the community. A person God created and loved to live forever with Him in that person's body has just died. It's a horrible thing. We ought to wail. It's okay to scream out and cry and mourn at death because it's a terrible thing. And God's going to defeat it in the end. So I think the Jews kind of had it right here. We have it wrong. This is the right way to react to death. Now, of course, these are professionals, so one of the reasons why you hire someone to do it is because, I don't know if you've ever had a really terrible loss. When I lost my grandmother, is the closest I can get to this. I was very close to her. But for some stinking reason, when I was at the funeral, I could not cry. I was broken down inside, but I could not weep. And I felt like someone should. My dad's not going to. He's stoic. And my mom, you know, I know she was very upset, but she didn't feel like she could cry because everyone was looking at us. Someone needed to mourn this beautiful woman's death, and no one could. For emotional reasons or whatever. That was the function of the professional mourner. They would come in to mourn as is appropriate at a death and also provide space for the family to grieve as they want to and as they can. It was a great tradition, but hiring mourners does have its drawbacks. By the way, I do want those people at my funeral. If I die tomorrow or the next day, please hire some professional mourners. Someone needs to cry. All right, so... hiring mourners does have a drawback, though. Let's look at verse 39. So Jesus comes in, he sees all this commotion, and he says, why are you weeping? This child isn't dead, but she's sleeping. And what do they do? Well, they laugh at him. Now, because they're professionals, they know death. They've seen death. They know what death looks like. And they've seen this girl, and they know she is dead. They know she's not sleeping. That's why they laugh. It's not a friendly laugh. It's not like, ha-ha, happy time laugh. It's a scornful laugh. It's a mocking laugh. There's two kinds of words for laughter in Greek. This is the scorn, mock kind of laugh. Had they understood Jesus' real meaning here, I think they would have scorned him even more greatly than they did. They would have mocked him even more. What is his real meaning? Well, some do say that Jesus really means sleeping here. This girl's in a coma. She's just asleep. So, God, hey, don't worry. Why are you crying? She's just asleep. And these are the same people who say, you know, you've heard them before. The same people who say that Jesus didn't really walk in the water. There was just a sandbar that came, you know, out further, and he was on it. But then Peter tried. He didn't get to the sandbar, and so he fell off. Or the same people who say that when Jesus multiplied the bread, that it was just the inspiring message that he preached led people to acts of generosity, and they shared their bread and their knapsacks, and it's really a story about human sharing, not about the miraculous power of Jesus. That's bunk. I heard that in seminary. That's bunk. It's not true. And the same thing here. Luke tells us in chapter 8, verse 55 of his text that her soul had left her body. She is dead. And so Jesus doesn't mean here that she has a coma or that she's just sleeping. He means she's dead. But the reason why, can anyone guess why he might use the word sleep to describe her condition, even though she's dead? Anyone? What happens when you sleep? You wake up, right? You're going to get up. He's using the word sleep here because he's saying this is temporary. I don't know if Jairus got that yet. He may have thought that he misdiagnosed his daughter's death. I don't know if anyone got that yet, but that's what he's meaning here. She's asleep. Her death is temporary. It will not stand. And so the mourners here are wrong to laugh. And in some ways, and this is important to see too, if you kind of pull back from this text, Mark is providing us a picture here of the scorn with which the world has always received Jesus' claims. We go out and talk to our non-Christian friends about the resurrection or about some of the claims that Jesus makes about himself. Often they're met with this kind of derision and scorn. This is the world's response. This is the response that Jesus has had so far in his ministry, a scorn. And because that's true, what we see with Jesus' response to this mocking and this scorn is a kind of warning to those of us who might be tempted to scorn what we know or what Jesus says, just to look on him with scorn. We're told there that he put them all outside. And that's a very nice way of saying it. He kind of, would you please leave? That's not what the Greek says. The Greek is ekbalo, which is threw out, like a bar, what's that guy's name? Bouncer. Thank you. Yeah, he threw him out of the bar. That's kind of language here. I don't know because I'd never go to a bar, but I know some of you do. And same language you get when he casts demons out of possessed people. Same word that you get when we hear about him driving the money changers out of the temple at Balo. He throws them out. And notice here, if this is kind of a portrait of the coming judgment, the only ones who remain in the house with Jesus are those who trust him. Those who trust him are still there. And everyone else, the scorners and the mockers, have been taken out of the house. Those who turn from themselves and trust him will be with him is the underlying message there. Now, the house now is quiet, but it's still a house of mourning. And let's look at verse 40. Jesus is going to change that. Jesus takes the father and the mother and those who are with him and went to where the child was. Now, she's probably lying in another room or maybe in the courtyard because touching a dead body makes you unclean. Being in the same room with the dead body, if you're a priest or a holy part of the Levites, would make you unclean. She's lying where people coming into the house wouldn't necessarily become unclean. But notice Jesus takes the parents and he takes his three disciples and he takes her, verse 41, by the hand. You see that? He doesn't have to do that. He doesn't have to do that. And same thing back on the beach. He didn't have to go to Jairus' house. All he has to say is, hey, get up. But he makes a point of taking this girl's hand. Same thing he did, if you remember, with the leper. He didn't just say to the leper, be cleansed. He touched the leper, something that would make him unclean. But what is he doing? Why is he making this decision to touch? Why is he doing that? Is he breaking the laws of God against touching unclean things or persons? The law against impurity or the laws defining what makes something unclean and how to clean it, all of those were meant by God to show or to reveal that because of sin, not just our souls, but all the material cosmos has been damaged and twisted and sin has wrecked everything, right? So the uncleanness kind of points to that. And along with that, God said, all right, well, if you are unclean, you need to wash yourself and then you need to wait a period of time and you need to go to the temple where when you offer a sacrifice, God will cleanse you of that uncleanness. Now, what does it mean then for Jesus just to touch someone and heal them and make them clean? What does it mean? There is an implicit, that means hidden, claim here that's made explicit elsewhere. And that is, Jesus is saying, you used to have to go to a place and kill an animal to be clean. I am now that place. I am now that person. What the temple used to be, the place where you got rid of sin, the place where God and man were reconciled as one, what the temple was in the old covenant, I am in the new covenant. I will make you clean. Uncleanness doesn't make me unclean. I take out uncleanness. I am not made unholy. I make you holy. That's what he's saying. So he takes her by the hand. Now the girl isn't there. Her body is there. She's gone. Perhaps She's already lost her color. Perhaps she's already lost the warmth in her body. But he speaks to her and he says to her, Talitha kumi, which means, as he says to us, little girl, arise. Now, Talitha is Aramaic and it does mean little girl, but it's an endearing term. Probably we would say little lamb here, little lamb. He's speaking to her as you would a small child. So get the contrast here. I mean, just hours ago, Jesus was commanding a hurricane to be quiet and casting out legions of demons from a demon-possessed man. He is everything that we think of when we read the Psalms about Yahweh, the mighty warrior. And just in an hour, he's sitting by this girl's bedside and taking her hand in his and calling her his little lamb. And he commands her to rise. Verse 42, immediately the girl got up and began walking. Before she was 12 years of age, and I guess that just means 12 years old, walk around. 12-year-olds walk around a lot. Who's seen Princess Bride? Anyone? Okay, so Wesley, the main character, gets killed. And so to fix that, his friends take Wesley to a guy named Miracle Max, who is able to raise the dead. And the way that Miracle Max raises the dead is he gets this, I guess, death-raising pill, and he coats it with chocolate, and then he shoves it down Wesley's mouth. And then sooner or later, Wesley kind of revives a little bit. But the rest of the movie, what's wrong? Anyone know? Seen it? What's wrong with Wesley the rest of the movie? He can't move. He's like, he's odd, so they have to like carry him everywhere, right? Because I would imagine that dying is fairly exhausting, and he's just tired. It would be kind of tired. And I think the same thing is probably true. If you see someone who's died on a hospital bed or in the emergency room, they don't just like pop up after that and go walk around. This detail is given to us so that we can see this is not a natural thing. This is not a natural resuscitation like we might see in the hospital. This is Jesus, by divine fiat, calling this little girl back to life, soul to body, and giving her the fullness of health in an instant. In an instant. Now, the Gospels do not record things like this very often. We only have two other occasions, the raising of Lazarus and the raising of the widow of Nain's son. It's rare. Jesus heals the sick. He will bring sick people to him, but he doesn't go on the graveyard tour, right? He doesn't go like just to graveyard raising the dead. Why not? Well, it's not time yet. It's not time yet. When he returns, what he's done for this little girl, he'll do for everyone. Everyone. For those who believe, this raising will be followed by the Lord himself wiping away from us all the pain and the sorrow and the loss of this life. And we'll just come out of our tombs, out of our graves. I don't care if you've been cremated or not. Jesus knows the blueprints. You're coming right back out immediately in the fullness of health. Fathers will be reunited with daughters they've lost and they've loved. Brothers and sisters, mothers and daughters will be reunited forever. This particular girl has not been raised in the same way we will be raised on the last day. This girl will die again. This is not a resurrection from which she will never have to suffer death again. This is a resuscitation. But Jesus raises her to point forward to that promise to us who stand on this side of mourning and on this side of death. And he says, stop fearing. Stop fearing. Wherever you are, and trust me, be believing. Trust me with your life, and not just with your life. I think the hardest thing, don't just trust me with your life. Trust me with the life of those you love, with your mother or your daughter or your son. Trust me, even when it seems lost. Trust me. I will raise up all my lambs. Verse 42, they were immediately overcome with amazement. Peter and James and John, think about what they've been through over the last 24 hours. They've seen everything. They've been through a whirlwind. They've seen Jesus' power over nature, his power over hell. They've seen his power over incurable sickness. They've now seen his power over death. Just a whirlwind. Imagine what Jairus must be feeling. Jesus, if you remember, promised no outcome. Jairus did not know for sure what was going to happen when they got home. But when all was lost, Jairus didn't leave Jesus alone. Like the messenger said, he stayed with him. He trusted him. And this is the outcome of his trust. This is it. Life from death. Life from death. It is the outcome of your faith. It will happen. It will happen. Maybe not in this period of time, on this side of the grave, but it will happen. It is the ultimate outcome for all who don't leave Jesus alone. Now, verse 43, and we'll close here. Very difficult to understand. He strictly charges them that no one should know this, and he tells them to give the daughter something to eat. I imagine dying is makes you hungry. I don't know. But they were so excited and noticed that she was hungry. But two questions. How on earth are they going to keep this quiet because Jairus came to Jesus in public and the messengers telling Jairus that his daughter was dead came in public? And then secondly, why on earth would you want to keep something like this under wraps? Why would you want to do that? Well, let me answer the why question real fast first. If people got the idea that Jesus is going to raise the dead, what do you think would happen? You have people be digging up the relatives, the bones and stuff, and bringing them to Jesus. People would be, it would be just mass chaos. It's already mass chaos with the healing. But imagine what would be with the resurrection. So he doesn't do that because he doesn't want to cause that kind of disruption. And it's not time yet to raise the dead. That's coming, but not yet. It would inhibit his mission of preaching, which is his primary mission. How would you keep something like that secret? And this, not too difficult if you think about it. What did Jesus tell the mourners before he kicked them out? She's asleep. So what do the parents have to say when someone asks why this girl is walking around now? Jesus was right. You should have listened to him. He was asleep. She's asleep. Right? Not that difficult. So that's how and why. We're going to stop here. Next week we'll come back and we'll dive into chapter 6, light speed. Next year, who knows? Or after that, we might be finished with the book. So let's pray. We'll go on. Father, thank you for these visions of what will be one day. One day all graves will open, all the dead will rise. All of this by the power of your own resurrection. Father, in the meantime, as you give us over to death, over and over again, you give those we love over to death. Lord, give us the grace to cling to you and to trust you and not to leave. Give us your strength to stay with you. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.